This is the John Clayton Show.
Brought to you by Coors Light, the world's most refreshing beer.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's get you up to date with some headlines. Seahawks get a 21-20 loss over to Minnesota, but did some pretty good things. The offense moved the ball pretty well. The run game was good. Russell Wilson had decent protection. There was good tackling on the defense, but there's still more things that need to be kind of cleaned up as far as the pass rush and some pass coverages and all those different things. But still, when the starters were in there, they had a 13-6 lead over the Minnesota Vikings, and so they're 0-3 now in the preseason. Closed everything out on Thursday against the Oakland Raiders. Looks like they escaped a game without any injuries, although, you know, last week they came out reasonably clean, but they lost J.D. McKissick. We'll see if there's going to be any more injuries, but Mike Dave suffered an ankle injury, came back in the game. Tedrick Thompson got a rib, but he was able to come back in the game. So again, they came out reasonably clean, which is what you want to do, particularly on the third preseason game. Speaking of third preseason games, I mean, this is getting ridiculous now with the way the preseason is constructed, because, you know, no Aaron Rodgers last night. The Chicago Bears just put out their starting lineup for today's game. 16 starters are not playing, and it's not as if they're like Dallas with injuries on the offensive line, or Green Bay with injuries on the offensive line, or the Rams with two injuries on the offensive line not playing Jared Goff. 16 starters not playing in what's supposed to be the dress rehearsal game. Very, very strange and very concerning. Mariners get a 6-3 victory last night, a big one in Arizona. And of course, you can see the value of the trade that they made with Taijuan Walker and Kentel Marte, because they were able to get four hits combined out of Mitch Haniger and Gene Segura. And then good pitching by Erasmo Ramirez and the 49 save by Edwin Diaz as they get the victory 6-3. Unfortunately for the Mariners, not able to gain ground on the A's, because the A's were able to get a victory actually here in Minnesota where I'm at, and the four-game lead still remains. Mariners now continuing that series in Arizona, and those are our headlines. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Joining us is Gary Hill from the Mariners broadcast, and Gary, that was a big victory and an important victory last night.
It really was. It was a big win, especially when you kind of look at how this next week, and I think this next week is going to be a big one. We've talked about this stretch the Mariners have been in, and it's been a tough one, facing the Astros, the A's, the Dodgers, the Astros again. Now the Diamondbacks, a first-place team. You look at how this next week sets up, four games behind the A's, a big series this weekend against the Diamondbacks. If you can at least split the next two, you hope that Minnesota can take one of the next two against the A's. And then going into Monday, the Mariners are off, two against the Padres. Meanwhile, the A's and Astros start a series together on Monday. If you're a Mariners fan, I think you're cheering for the Astros in that one, because at the end of this trip, after two against the Padres, the Mariners and A's hook up for four games. And if you can get some help from the Astros, if you take care of business against the Padres, and you have a chance to really brush up next against the A's with four games head-to-head. So this next week is going to be really big. This is a big trip, and that was a great way to start the trip against a really good Diamondbacks team.
Yeah, but boy, just it's amazing. You talk about the flips, and obviously Arizona has some very good pitching, but you know, their hitting has been not up to speed, particularly after trading away Gene Segura and Mitch Haniger, and those guys combined for the four hits and did some good things. And you know, here's two all-stars now sitting on the Mariners, who were sitting a little more than a year ago with the Diamondbacks.
Yeah, that had to make the fans on hand weep watching Mitch Haniger go to work, because that has got to be tough to watch. I mean, two all-stars that the Diamondbacks traded away. And Mitch Haniger is just lights out right now in the month of August. He has been sensational, having just really a monster month. You look at what he's doing, batting .363 for the month, a .410 on base percentage. He's got 10 doubles, which is tied for the most in the American League, three homers as well. He is doing it all at the top of the lineup. Segura's really coming around too offensively. He's been in a nice groove, and the timing could not be better. Especially, it's tough in an NL park. You don't have Nelson Cruz in the lineup. You can unleash him late in a ball game in a big situation, but without him in the lineup, you need other guys to step forward, and they certainly did last night. But Mitch Haniger has been so much fun to watch. And you're right about Arizona. I mean, you do have Goldschmidt in the middle, who's one of the best hitters in the National League, but they really have made their way on their pitching this year. Their bullpen is really good, and they've added to it by adding Ziegler and Diekman. And the rotation has been excellent. And Mariners sweep Greinke on Sunday, which is never easy. They'll face Robbie Ray tonight, who's really good. He's taken a step back from where he was last year, but Buchholz has had a nice year. Corbin, who they won't see, has had a nice year. So the pitching has really been the name of the game for Arizona, and in a very tough NL West, they're in first place, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, it really is, because you figured that this was going to be one where the Dodgers were going to almost run away with it, and that has not happened, and they're just holding everything off right now. How strange is it right now with the state of the pitching staff, where when you think about the struggles of Marco Gonzalez and now have to stretch him out days, you know, Mike Leake having that mysterious type of illness has scratched him, and of course he's been very consistent. You know, Felix just trying his best to hold on, that the guys that they're starting to have to rely on with James Paxton out is, Wade LeBlanc and Erasmo Ramirez.
Yeah, how good has Erasmo Ramirez been? I don't think you could have asked for any more these last three starts. I mean, he gave up one earned last night, one earned the start before that, zero earned the start before that. He's been excellent for the Mariners at a time where they've badly needed him. The good news is Leake is going to start in this series, so he appears to be better. And really, he's been the most consistent starter for the Mariners since the end of May. You look back at his numbers, and he's got an ERA just a touch over 3. It may not show up in the overall numbers. His first 9 starts, he had an ERA of 6. So it's taken a while to whittle it down, but he's been really good for a long time. It's great to see him healthy, and he'll be back against Arizona, which is great. Sounds like Paxton will be ready to go in Oakland, which will be huge. We're hesitant starting him in the National League Park because of the at-bats, which I totally understand, especially with Oakland on the horizon. It's great to have him against the A's, so that's good news as well. Felix has shown some signs as well. Gonzalez has struggled, as you mentioned, but really, the way I look at this thing, a handful of days left until September, I think they're going to call up every available arm they can and really just take it day by day in September. A lot of arms that they'll be able to go to. And if a guy just doesn't have it in the rotation that day, just go to the bullpen early. I mean, I really think that's going to be how it operates in September.
Yeah, I would have to think so, too, because, I mean, they're at that stage, you know, with the fact that Paxton's been out, although I guess in some ways for the September run that may help because, you know, his innings, I think, had to be a little bit of a concern because, he had started to reach a high area, but maybe this time off can maybe keep him fresh going into September. That could work out well. And then, Felix has to, plow through things, and I don't know what thing did he find in that last inning or so that really kind of helped out, because I know that Scott Service came over to him and was appreciative of what he was able to do. I mean, it looked like he did pick up something that he had not been picking up before.
Yeah, and Scott Service has been pretty vague on it, and I am very anxious to see his next start because of that. Because, and you saw in the dugout, they had a long conversation after that inning. Scott Service was pretty excited about what he saw from Felix Hernandez. The question is, can Felix take whatever that was, getting more extension and taking it into his next start? I mean, that becomes the next question. If he pitches the way he did the last three innings of that start, that would be fantastic for the Mariners moving forward, because he was really good. Didn't have much of a changeup in that start, but had a really good curveball. We saw his velocity spike a little bit, 92, including the last inning that he threw, which was a good sign. And not only the velocity, it's the command. That's what was the key. He was commanding the fastball, keeping it low in the zone. And we've seen some really good signs his last couple of outings. If he can take that into his next start, I mean, it's hard to talk about how much that would help the Mariners down the stretch if he could be that guy to give the Mariners 5-6 innings and give them a chance to win every time he takes the mound. Because that's what you're asking for. You're not asking for 6-7 shutout innings. Just keep him in the game and let the offense go to work. That's the key.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no question. And that's going to be interesting to see how he continues to handle it. But, it's almost like every – every game for him creates new decisions. I mean, they put him in the bullpen, then he comes in the bullpen, goes 5 2/3 innings, gets back in the starting rotation, and now is trying to get comfortable again in getting some things done. And whatever it was, that had to be a little bit encouraging to Scott Servais. Let's go to the batters and all that right now. I mean, I guess the one thing that Kyle Seager has continued to struggle, what's he need to do to kind of get things going on the right direction?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Because it's been a struggle for him
this year.
$14
million based on his salary, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, with Seager, and at least early in the season, his production was there. You saw the home run totals, the RBI totals, doubles, everything like that was there. The batting average really hasn't been there all season long. The defense, for the most part, except for the last couple of weeks, has been outstanding, really having the best defensive year of his career up to the last couple of weeks. I think it, and not only Kyle Seager in this situation, I think there's a lot of lefty pull hitters in a similar situation. I'm sure he has some swing adjustments to go along with it, but the game has changed on a lot of veteran lefty pull hitters, and he's not alone in this, but the amount he is being shifted on compared to the amount he was shifted on just a couple of years ago is pretty staggering when you think about it. He was, I think, 3 years ago being shifted on about 30% of the time, which isn't a ton, and now it's over 70% of the time, which is a ton when you can think about that in comparison factors. So we've seen a lot of lefties struggle with it. Guys like Chris Davis also has some contact issues, but when he makes contact, he can't buy a base hit. And then some guys we've seen overcome it, like Matt Carpenter, really kind of suffered against it last year. This year, just kind of hitting over the shift, hitting a ton of home runs. So it's easier said than done for these hitters to say, well, why don't you just take it the other way? Because we talk about some of the greatest hitters that baseball has seen going the other way. You're talking about, you know, Tony Gwynn and, you know, Rod Carew and guys like that. But those are Hall of Famers. It's not a skill set that every single hitter has. So it's a complicated issue to try and get around, especially for a guy who's kind of done it one way his entire life. You know, he's been a lefty pull hitter his entire career. So I don't have the answer, and I'm sure if they had the answer, they would have it figured out by now. I think it's just a work in progress, especially with the shift involved. It is really tough on left-handed pull hitters, and Seager's one of the guys that's really affected.
What exactly do they do on the shift that takes things away as a pull hitter?
Well, the difference is, you know, when you're a right-handed hitter, and take Albert Pujols, for example, the shortstop can still only play so deep because they have to make the long throw to first base. So even Pujols, for as much as he struggles getting down the line, the deepest a shortstop can really play is the grass, which still allows a righty pull hitter to get it by the shortstop, either over his head or off to either side. The problem with a lefty pull hitter is, and we see this all the time, the second baseman is essentially playing a rover in short right field, and then you shift the shortstop over to the second base side. It just really eliminates where a lefty pull hitter can go. And we've seen it a ton of times where a ball gets tagged, and the second baseman is in short right field standing right there, and the throw is so short from second to first that they can afford to play that deep and still make the throw to first base. The margin for error on base hits shrinks so much, even if you crush a ball. It just makes it so much more difficult, and it's a natural disadvantage, I guess, for a lefty hitter as opposed to a righty hitter because of the throw is shorter.
Interesting. So that should be one that you'll have to figure out a way to do it. But I wonder now, how long do you get the feeling, because of the way that this game is evolving, that some of the shifting is going to be taken away?
I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be taken away by the rules. I think it may be taken away by hitters. I think this is an especially tough issue for guys that have been in the league for a long time. Not only in the league for a long time, but playing baseball for, you know, professional baseball for a decade or so. I think this is pretty sudden for guys like that. I think what we're going to see is minor leaguers figuring it out. I think it's easier for guys coming up to try to figure out how to hit the ball the other way, trying to spray the ball. I think teams put more value on guys that can spray the ball around the yard, or guys with just supreme power that they're going to hit over the shift, like Joey Gallo, for example. But I think baseball may take care of itself in that regard and eliminate the shift. Not eliminate the shift. I think it's always going to be there, but lessen the impact of the shift naturally instead of going by the rules. I think it just takes time, and the adjustment is really hard for the guys in the league right now that are just used to doing it one way.
Yeah, which leads to the final question. I mean, it does seem like with the acquisitions of Jerry DePoto, is that in some ways, is he doing what you're saying, kind of getting those young guys who know how to spread the ball around?
I think it is a value that we're going to see moving forward. And we see it with Mitch Haniger. He's a guy that can go to all fields, and he can hit for power for all fields. You see it with Gene Segura. Robbie Cano's always been that kind of hitter. So they do have those type of hitters. It's such an interesting question, and I think, you know, making a rule change would be really difficult as is, too, because I'm not sure how you enforce that rule. You have somebody stand, and the minute a pitch gets made, they can start running off somewhere else if they wanted to. I mean, I think it's a really difficult rule to enforce, and I just think the value of hitters like that will go up because of that, because they don't have to deal with the shift. And for pull guys, it almost becomes kind of, well, do I try and figure out how to hit against the shift, or do I just try and, you know, the other question is, do I just accept that my average is going to be low and I just kind of sell out for power, trying to increase the home run totals, try and increase the RBI totals, and just really sacrifice the average, because the average may not be anywhere with the shift. So I think there's a few different strategies, a few different ways to look at it, and I think a lot of guys are stuck trying to figure that out right now.
Well, it was a big win for the Mariners last night. We'll see if it can continue tonight. Gary Hill, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem at all. Always fun to talk, John. Thank you.
Okay. That's Gary Hill, and of course, broadcast going to be today, 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com. Now, more John Clayton.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Brandon. Brandon, how are you?
Hey, John. How you doing today?
Doing good.
Good, good, good. You enjoyed the game last night, I take it.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, what was nice is that, now again, you know, these preseason games have really become brutal. You know, that second half of the Charger game really, really was boring. But what I liked about it is that the intensity was there. And you can see that, you know, you have a Super Bowl caliber team with the Vikings. I think a team that can at least challenge for the playoffs in Seattle. And, you know, Seattle didn't back down. Now, I know that sounds strange to a team that's now been to two Super Bowls. But with the new guys on the team, what I liked is that you saw intensity there. I mean, you know, like, for example, there was at least three, four, or five plays where, you know, being on the Vikings sidelines, I had to just kind of be on guard because, you know, the hitting was such that, you know, they would drive the guy over to the sidelines, and you have to kind of make that one move. I think there was only one time that I kind of got my foot tied up with one of the tight ends from the Vikings and didn't have to go down or anything like that. But that's where the speed of the game really picked up. I mean, the speed of the game last night for the first three quarters, or at least the first two quarters and a half, was at, you know, regular season type level.
Absolutely. And your lateral quickness looked just like Alex Magoo.
Yeah, exactly. Except when, you know, there was somebody came in when as he came in on the blitzes and he had no way to go. But, you know, I'm tell you what, I mean, I know that his first series was awful. I mean, he was off on just about every throw. But I think there's something about Magoo I really like.
Absolutely. His deep out throws, where he's throwing those 15 to 25 intermediate routes where they have an outbreaking route, he throws a laser.
Oh, agreed. And see, I mean, what I like is that, you know, there's certain throws that I think he's still having to work on, but, I mean, his tight throws over the middle are real good. His scrambling ability is good, and his ability to improvise is good. And so, you know, the one pick was bad, but, you know, he makes mistakes. But I really, there's something there. You know,
absolutely. Do you think
I think that he,
will
he has the edge.
Do you think he'll... You do. So that's I guess this is question 1A, and then I have some follow-up offensive line questions. Do you... I don't think he... If they kept him on the practice squad, I think somebody else would pick him up. Do you save a roster spot and keep him as the third quarterback on the roster, or is he the true, do you think, backup number two quarterback?
I think they may have to really consider him strong to be the backup quarterback, you know, because, okay. And maybe that's going to be a gamble because, you know, certainly you go from the experience. But remember, it's not as if they haven't done it before. Trevon Boykin, sure. You know, won the backup job, and he was an undrafted guy. I know he had a mid-round grade and all that stuff. But what I like about Magoo is that, you know, he can go in there, kind of scramble and get away with some things. And that, I think, is encouraging. You know, Austin Davis is solid, not great, but solid. Yeah. But I think there's more upside with Magoo because he just, you know, I mean, how about that, him running around on the Hail Mary pass and then somehow, some way,
and they're five
scrambling like
short.
Russell Wilson. Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't think
gets the ball completed to the two.
That much. Right. Right. Now, I guess a follow up question then would be pertaining to the offensive and defensive line. So, Puna Ford, who I saw at training camp, is. Mm-hmm. Maybe 5'10", 5'11", and about 350. He's a big man, and he's good. Mm-hmm. He's a good player. So, Puna Ford question, and then also, do you think Jordan Roos will unseat J.R. Sweezy? I don't know if J.R. Sweezy is going to make the team.
It's still debatable because he really hasn't settled into a spot yet. Roos has really done well and has, you know, I think maybe secured himself as the number one guard. You know, what I was wondering about with Sweezy was that, because the one thing I think you have to be still concerned about is that you probably want as much starting experience as you can, knowing that you don't know if DJ Fluker can make it through the entire year. I mean, you know, he's 343 pounds. You know he's going to be the starter at right guard. But again, you have to kind of back yourself up. And that's where J.R. Sweezy, I think, could be valuable. So I think it does come down to Sweezy going against Roos for that last spot. Sure. But I know that the players really like Roos, and I think he goes well in the system. But, you know, they've got to test out. And I think the one concern has to be, you know, Sweezy is coming off a high ankle sprain. So, I mean, you're not getting the full J.R. Sweezy. You know, you're getting a guy that is not going to be able to move as well. I mean, go back to Dwayne Brown last year. You know, Dwayne Brown played with a high ankle sprain, and that was a real struggle. And so he did well under the circumstances. You know, but going back to your question about keeping three quarterbacks, you know, that's the luxury I don't think they have the ability to do, because I think you'd like to be able to keep a Puna Ford. I think you'd like to be able to keep – I think you almost with the way that the injuries have been at the running back position, I think you have to keep five.
Even a TJ, a follow-up question, you looked at when Tedrick Thompson went out, they were forced to put Mike Tyson – in at free safety.
Yeah.
I really liked watching training camp TJ Mutcherson. I thought he had a chance as a ball hawk, but agreed, if you keep that third quarterback, that means exactly a Puna Ford or a backup safety.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's going to be pretty clear that they're going to keep six wide receivers, with, I think, Marcus Johnson beating out Amara Darbo and Stringfellow and McElvoy as the sixth, because you know, he also has value. I mean, he makes big catches, he's fast, and now you can see he has value on special teams. And if you're going to be a sixth receiver, you've got to be on special teams. Simple as that. Particularly knowing that Brandon Marshall's not going to do
it. Tanner McElvoy. Ball from grace for Tanner McElvoy.
I don't call it a fall from grace when you start bringing in guys who can run 4.3 40s and catch the ball. I mean, Jaron Brown looks good. And sure. I think you can see David Moore has made a just amazing. I mean, how about the fact that now you can even have him on the return game?
Absolutely.
With that punt return for a touchdown.
Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, Brandon, thank you. Let's go to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
For you today. Hey, Mike,
I'm
I got two
well.
Questions. On the two-point conversion play, when our defender came up and, you know, whacked the guy, you think if he would have just came up and traditionally just tried to run through him with a, you know, a strong tackle, he would have knocked him down? Because he sure looked surprised when the guy didn't go down, and, you know, the guy made a hell of a play to stick that ball in there for the two-pointer.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, he's a pretty good back, I can tell you that right now, because I know being on the sidelines, they were talking him up. I mean, what he had led the team in rushing last week for the Vikes. And you know, I think it's just a matter that, you know, here it is, you're late in the game and all that stuff. And, you know, now you've got a back that is much better than you anticipate, and so he just won that battle. I don't know if it was a strategy or anything else. I just think it was a win for the running back, and that just happens. I mean, you see the wins that Chris Carson has had, and Mike Davis have had some last night. When you're talking in the fourth quarter of the third preseason game, and it's kind of garbage time and all that stuff, I don't overreact to that. You know,
well,
again,
I
what you look at is
management. I just thought, traditionally you would see a guy kind of try to wrap him up instead of just laying the big lick, and the guy automatically goes down. Well, this guy didn't automatically go down.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the difference right now, because I think all defenders are trying to figure out the right way to do it. One, they're trying to avoid getting the penalty, and they're trying to make an adjustment, and that's not the easiest thing to do. That's why these preseason games are valuable, because you can test things out and see what works and what doesn't work, and if it didn't work, maybe the thing that he'll learn from is what you have to do the next time you're going to be able to do it. But
my second question, I've been Canada fishing when Tiger Woods got second at the PGA. Did he actually come close to winning it, or was he just end up second?
No, he came close. I mean, it's what you can see with Tiger now is that he takes steps now each time that he's in these tournaments. Because normally, I mean, go back and see if you agree with this. You go back by, I'd say when he first started coming back, he'll get to like the 12th, 13th hole, and then his putting would fall apart. Okay, so now he can get to the 16th and 17th before his putter starts to go against him. Once he gets that putter solved, then I think everything's going to be okay, and he's going to start winning these tournaments. Because
I watched him yesterday, and he looked as he shot even par for the two rounds, but he looked as surly as he always does. He always looks like he's upset with that amount of talent. I don't know what the guy has to be upset about. I mean, he can't win them all. But I just don't believe.
We got to understand his mentality. I mean, that was his mentality. He wanted to win them all when he was out there, when he was in his prime. Now he's getting closer. You can see the frustration, but I think he is going to start getting some wins.
So is Brooks Koepka a new superstar then?
What's that again?
Brooks Koepka, the guy that won the PGA, falling off.
Yeah,
from the U.S.
Well, he's won three, right?
Yeah,
three majors.
Is
so.
That guy?
Yeah, I mean, he's now on the radar. I mean, everybody knows about him because in the big tournaments, he's going to be there. Hey, thank you for the phone call,
and I'm glad you
had a good fishing trip. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, more John Clayton on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Jet. Jet, how are you?
I'm well, John. How are you today?
Doing well. So your thoughts on the Sam Darnold experiment?
Well, in all fairness, full disclosure here, I've not seen the game.
Okay.
It was blacked out on SNY last night.
Oh,
and,
no.
And the football channel is not showing it until 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. As well as I've seen our highlight clips that I found on various sites on the web. So I didn't get a chance to see the full game, so... I'm kind of shooting in the dark here for right now, but hey, that's never stopped a Jet fan in the past.
So now,
what do
I
you
mean,
think?
Figuring,
you, what do you,
you
think?
Know, it's the. I mean, again, I still think it was the best quarterback in the draft, and I think it was a steal that the Jets were able to get him. Because now I think, as much as I do like, and I do like Baker Mayfield, because I think he's going to be good, I just think Sam Darnold's going to be better, and I think they're both going to be good. But now, can you live with the fact that you're going to have a quarterback that's going to be throwing in the 50% range, 55, 56%, and having his touchdowns in the teens, I don't know where he's going to be for interceptions, but can you live with that?
Well, heck, we've been living with that for years.
Yeah, that's true.
I think, can Jet fans tolerate that? Hey, we've tolerated that for 40 years. I guess my thought is this. I think right now the Jets are going to have difficulty running the ball.
Agreed.
So that's not going to help a young quarterback. I think the Jets are going to have a chronic problem with the offensive line this year. I suspect it's going to improve after the first month, especially if they can get a healthy Brian Winters out there finally and a healthy Beecham out there at tackle. But unless you're going to resolve particularly that left tackle issue, your offensive line just is going to really struggle. And from what I've read in the few clips that I've seen, it looks like he was running for his life quite a bit yesterday. Now, again, they're going to the new scheme, and I think it's going to take the offensive line time to gel, if in fact they ever do. So I'm thinking that I still want to see a veteran go out there for the first three, four starts at least. See what happens. Take the team's lumps as they try to transition into Bates' new offense. And then let Donald watch from the side, but also let him get a feel for what a pro week is like. You know, get in the flow of things. Especially because I think the first 4 weeks of the season, if I'm not mistaken, I think they've got a Monday night and a Thursday night game. So you talk about flow, especially one of them is mm-hmm. at the Thursday night game. Hey, man, that's a quick turnaround for anybody,
right?
Yet alone a rookie who's just kind of watching everything for the first time. So I'd like to see him get past that that first Thursday game, you know, and let one of the two other quarterbacks play. And then, you know, I'm expecting that it's going to be a dumpster fire. And then you also get the fans starting to clamor, say, we want Darnold. He can come in and maybe be in a potential, if not savior-type situation, at least be in a situation where, hey, he's no worse than what we've had before. And I think that's a much easier situation for the kid to walk into than try to start him from day one, especially with a couple of those short weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no,
I
would agree with
that. And I'm concerned that that line
well,
really yeah, is not going to make
it. But I think you bring a good point is, because I mean, you can see all signs are pointing to him starting, but it's like, what's the purpose of starting him when there's not enough good things around him? Because all you're doing is setting him up for failure. And that's going to be, you know, a disaster because, I mean, it's like, okay, so it'll end up costing Todd Bowles his job. You know, that means a new offensive coordinator more than likely. And it just sets everything back for a year where I know they didn't play McCown last night. I just think it's better to go into the season with McCown.
I fully agree, John. I agree. Again, what's the hurry? You know, mm-hmm. you're an unlikely playoff team this year. You know, I understand that they want to win every game possible, and I still have to believe that McNown's going to give you a better chance at that at this particular juncture than Darnold will. And then mm-hmm. see what the first month brings you. I mean, you've got a young team. You've made an awful lot of changes. Let's see if it starts to gel after a month. Because I just get the sense, especially on offense, it's going to be chaos that first month.
Yeah.
And
no,
why subject a kid to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, I mean, The strategy now has to be, when you draft a quarterback, you should almost have a mandate that you can't play him in the first 6 weeks of the season. You know, I guess not like it's a physically unable to perform list, but it's the physically you shouldn't do it list.
Yeah, psychologically unable to perform list.
Right, right. Because, again, it's like too much. And then, of course, if you don't have the weapons and you look at that receiving group, you look at the offensive line, you go, ugh.
Yeah, I'm not too concerned about the receiving core. I think... Well, you got a bunch of no-names. I think you got guys that can cobble it together. They really don't have the long-range, you know, breakout player. You know, Robbie Anderson's mm-hmm. there, but I'm not entirely sold on him. I get that, but I think they have enough to work a West Coast offense.
Right.
Where I'm still, you know, extraordinarily concerned about is that offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
They're terrible.
Yeah, they are.
And I don't see how...
Well, and the bad part is like, okay, so they're bad up front, but they have no backups.
Well, that's just it, too. I mean, and their backups were Elijah Lana, who's out, and Quale, mm-hmm. who really just can't carry the load, and he's been further exposed. You know, that's just it. Their backups just aren't very good and haven't been very good. And now, unfortunately, they've moved to the spot where they've become the starters. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I understand, you know, we've talked previously about, and I don't entirely fault McCagnan for this because you can only fill so many holes. And with the upcoming draft supposedly loaded, particularly in not just on defensive linemen, but on offensive tackles in particular. So I can see them going big next year's draft, but you still got to get through this year. And, man,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't really think you want the kid out there that first month.
No, I agree. I think that this is one where it's better served to let him wait. By the way, final thought here, I interviewed Jamal Adams. Boy, mm-hmm. do I respect that guy as a leader. He really is good.
Yeah, yeah. And I really hope he ups his game this year to match his, as some would say, to match his mouth, because
mm-hmm.
He definitely has, he has that it factor, if you want to call it that. And
right.
Again, I don't get to see what happens in the clubhouse, so I don't know how the other guys respond to him. Maybe you've got some insight on that. which is obviously
important. No, they respond to him well because, you know, his big mission is to get as many people in the room trying to look at tape and study things. No, I really like him a lot. I mean, we had an in-depth conversation and found out how good of a guy he is and how valuable he is for the team and how intense he is.
Well, like we've been talking, you know, I mean, that's the kind of kid or that's the kind of player we need to see rise to the top of this organization.
Right.
So that you got some semblance of leadership to, you know, stop these guys from, you know, mucking up on the highways at 3 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the kind of thing that we need to see develop. And if it has to come internally, it has to come internally. But that's really good to hear and good to know.
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, thank you for the phone call.
All right. Take care,
Let's
John.
Go
Let's see
to...
what happens next week.
Sounds good. Let's go to Brad in Elma. Hey, Brad.
Hey, John. Hey,
how you doing?
Just things on a personal note before I go to the Hawks.
Yeah.
But here a while back, your wife wasn't had a little bit of problems. How's she doing?
Doing better. You know, still trying to get a little stronger and trying to, you know, see if you can get some walking done. And that's, you know, it's a challenge every day, but, you know, she's up to the challenge. And, you know, it's my job to take care of her, and I try to do the best I can. But thank you for asking.
Hey, that's great. That's a good example for all of us out there. Take care of our wives.
But, mm-hmm.
I think the Scottish used to call a professor that they particularly like the prof, and then give your ability as a foreseer of events in the NFL. Anybody ever call you the prof?
Professor? Yeah, I'm called the professor all the time.
What about the prof? P-R-O-F.
The prof. Nobody's called me the prof, no.
I'm reaching there. But anyway, Seahawks.
Yeah.
We're talking about the backup quarterbacks. I didn't get to see the game last night, but the first two games, Davis, you know, I don't really care about whether or not they complete the passes in the preseason, unless it's a real problem. But the one thing that bothers me about Davis is that he seems to, you watch the game, and he gives up before, you know, he goes to the ground, or he doesn't extend the play like what we're used to with Russell, or even Magoo. Magoo works hard.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, he doesn't have that athletic ability. You know, that's that would
that
be like asking.
Not drive,
yeah, it is. It's like
attitude.
He's a pocket passer. And so, I mean, that would be like using the same criticism on Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, and some other quarterbacks. I mean, Drew Brees. I mean, that's, you know, Austin Davis's game is his mind. I mean, he's got a very good mind for football, reasonably accurate. Maybe doesn't have the strongest arm, but he's not as mobile. I mean, Alex Magoo is mobile. I mean, you can see that particularly in the Hail Mary play where he ran around for probably 12 seconds to buy time and was able to get that pass down to the 2-yard line. Russell Wilson is amazing as far as that escapability, but, you know, he can't be criticized for the talent when that's not his skills. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to the John Clayton Show on 710 ESPN Seattle and 710sports.com.
866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. Let's go to Kyle in Bellingham. Hey, Kyle.
Hey, a fine morning to you, John. How are you today?
Doing well. Fine morning to you.
Fantastic. Today's a very important day. I will be stuck in a room with some of the most venomous lying thieves ever as I have my fantasy draft today. And I needed a couple pieces of advice, maybe a few dark horses from you, Professor, on who you think will lead the league in rushing yards and touchdowns and in receiving yards and touchdowns.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, Antonio Brown's the best receiver in the league right now and probably the number one guy to look to because he's been able to consistently put this together for years and years and years. You look on the running back side, I mean, I think a lot of people are starting to favor, you know, either Todd Gurley or they're looking at Le'Veon Bell. I mean, you know they're going to get the touches and all that stuff. You know, Le'Veon, of course, is still holding out, but he'll be showing up by Labor Day. So I think they would be considered among the top two. And I think you can see there's a little strain right now on Saquon Barkley because, you know, he's been lingering a little bit with that hamstring injury, and Eli Manning even called him out a little bit this week. But I think that you know that Julio Jones is set to have a real good year again, you know, because he's just that talented. So they would be among the guys. And as far as the rushing touchdowns, I mean, Huh, because that's one that, you know, you go with the high-powered offenses and that, and, you know, that's where you might go to Gurley, because, you know, Gurley has been, you know, he's now really at the top of his game. He's the highest-paid running back. You know, you got the $14.35 million contract. So I think you kind of favor him a little bit.
Okay. John, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you. 866-979-ESPN, 206-421-ESPN. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.